Okay, welcome everyone. This is the Tech Ed session on Office 365 Service Reliability and Disaster Recovery. My name is Kumar Venkateswar. This is Bharath Rambhadran. We're here to present what I think is an exciting topic. Thank you all for coming at such an early time. I know for me personally, it's 5:30 in the morning Pacific time, so it feels really early. So I'm pretty sure all of you really, really want to know what we're presenting here. So just to present a context, we have quite a few sessions on Office 365, and this is one of the last ones that we have to offer at TechEd. We've got a couple other sessions coming after this. So if you're interested in other Office 365 content, we've got a few. So for this session, we wanted to present to you what our thinking went into Office 365, how we engineered it for reliability and predictable delivery of the service. And we wanted to also present to you information that you get if we have any service availability interruptions. We wanted to present to you the kind of information that we present to you so you understand what's happening during the outage. We feel that this is a pretty important thing for you to understand when you have an outage. And I say when. We do a lot of things in order to make sure that the outages are as rare as possible, but realistically, this is just like any other service, whether it's on-premises or in the cloud, there will be interruptions. And we also want to go ahead and describe how we work to make sure that the incidence of these service interruptions is rarer and rarer as time goes on. And I want to present to you what thinking goes into the design so that we make sure that this is as rare as possible. I'm sure all of you understand, I mean, running your own servers, that the picture is more nuanced than just the SLA numbers. And we try to put together a view of the big picture and why the numbers alone are not sufficient to tell you how we have a thoughtful offering. So in order to kind of set the agenda, I want to talk to you about what the uptime is, and I'll present what the number is to get started. And then we'll talk about what goes into the number, how it translates into your organizations. And Bharath here will present the process that we go through whenever there's an outage. And we'll talk a little bit about how our approach is different than our competitors, and going forward, what kinds of steps that we take to make sure that we're continuously getting better. So let's start off with the number. We have consistently exceeded 99.9% uptime for the last 9 months, I'm pretty sure. We've also, and I don't have the exact number, but I'm fairly sure that we've also exceeded 4 nines. So we've got a pretty good aggregate availability number, and I stress the word aggregate, because this isn't necessarily the view that's experienced by any single organization. This is taking Office 365 as a whole. So how do we get there? What are the things that we do in order to make sure that we're getting to a consistently high number? So one of the things that I'd like to stress is that this isn't a new thing for Microsoft. We have years and years of doing these high-scale services, starting with Windows Update, which I believe is north of 500 million PCs now that are using the service. Hotmail, which is 350 million accounts, over 350 million. There's Bing and Xbox Live. Exchange-hosted services. How many of you have used hosted services? Can I see a show of hands? So quite a few people, maybe about 10 or 12 people, have used Exchange-hosted services. This is now part of the Office 365 offering. So even though it's a new brand and in some sense a new offering, it leverages the experience that we have in building these high-scale, high-reliability services. So to jump in, what does resilience consist of? There's different ways to provide resilience. If you look at the top right, there's anticipation and absorption, and these are processes that let you not have the outage altogether. If you anticipate that you're going to have a problem and you can take an action before the problem actually occurs, then you continue to have availability. Or if you design it in such a way that you have excess capacity and you can absorb a partial outage, then again, you have a resilient service. The other things that you can do in general at a high level, you can reconfigure the service in order to make sure that the load is redistributed, or you can take actions to restore service. And again, there's a lot of, if you look at kind of academic thinking, there's a lot of design heuristics that people use in order to implement this type of resilience. And I'll go ahead and provide some examples about how we're implementing these design heuristics in Office 365. So functional redundancy is one of the ones that I think is pretty important. And the essence of functional redundancy is that there's two paths to providing the functionality. So for instance, Outlook, how many of you have used Outlook? So pretty much everybody. If you use Outlook in cached mode, it provides a different set of functionality when you're online than when you're offline. So if the server you're connecting to or anything between your computer and the server that you're connecting to is down, it provides you with that functionality. It continues to provide you with that functionality even though that path doesn't exist. So you have a parallel path, whether you're online or offline, and this design heuristic allows you to continue providing productivity even though you've had a failure of the link to your server. So this is one of the principles that we use in order to provide redundancy and continued reliability of the service. Another example of functional redundancy is if you have two pipes that are to the outside world, two network pipes that are going through separate providers. And some people think of that as a form of physical redundancy. You've got two pipes. But if you have two pipes that are going to the same provider, they're actually physically redundant. There's if you lose one pipe, you have another to take over the load. But that doesn't insulate you against the kind of carrier failures that you can have. So for instance, a major carrier late last year had an outage for an extended period of time. And because of that outage, if you had two paths to that carrier, if you didn't have functional redundancy, you would have ended up losing availability. And in order to continue providing service, you would have had to have two paths to two different carriers. And this is one of the principles that we use in order to, in Office 365, in order to make sure that we have continued reliability. Physical redundancy is another one. For instance, if you have disk failures, you obviously want to have multiple disks that provide mirroring or RAID type of functionality. But if you think about it, these two functional and physical redundancy go hand in hand. I can tell you a story about how earlier in the BPOS days, the predecessor to Office 365, we actually had disks from a particular manufacturer that were used in order to store data. And what we didn't realize at the time is that this particular batch of disks was defective, and they continued running, but when they failed, they actually all failed at pretty much the same amount of time. So when we had these redundant disks, we didn't realize that we're going to see, you know, we had, I believe in this case, we had four copies of the data. We were going to see three of the copies just like that. Those disks would blow up. And we ended up going down to a single copy of the data. And that was before we realized that by using disks from the same batch, from the same manufacturer, that we were implementing physical redundancy, but we didn't have functional redundancy in the sense that they were going through the same manufacturing processes, they had the same disk firmware, everything about them was the same. So in spite of the fact that you use physical redundancy as a way to provide continued resilience, you want to make sure that physical and functional redundancy go hand in hand. So now we make sure to not deploy disks. You know, this is one of those things. We make sure not to deploy disks from the same manufacturer in a way that these disks are dependent on the others surviving. Another principle, I mean, you can see another example of this in physical redundancy where we have at least two data centers per region. I mean, if you're going along and you have one data center, you never know when you can have something like a lightning strike or a transformer explosion. We had something similar happen in Office 365. We had a transformer explosion in Dublin that took our data center out. And the fact that we actually had a backup data center in Amsterdam would have let us fail over to that data center, providing that the outage would have taken longer to restore service to rather than failing over. So this is one of those things. I mean, it's not just us that's vulnerable. There were other cloud providers that were affected by the same transformer outage as well. And this is in spite of the fact that we had redundant power supplies. This particular transformer failure took out not just the primary power supply, but it also took out the entire subsystem that would fail over to the backup generator. So having these multiple levels of physical and functional redundancy working together really makes for a much more resilient service. And we believe in Office 365 that we can provide that level of functionality to every size of customer, whether educational, public sector, any segment. We believe we can provide that functionality by implementing Office 365. Another principle that we use is the principle of reorganization. So I know Father's Day is coming up, and with Father's Day coming up, if there's an increase in traffic to particular customers, so for instance, if you have a customer that runs a golf course, it's probably reasonable to assume that they're going to have more traffic. We aren't necessarily able to anticipate that in advance. I mean, if it's Father's Day, it's pretty predictable. Back to school is another one that we see pretty often in educational institutions. We see a massive increase in traffic. We've seen this in the past on specific organizations and the specific servers that are serving those organizations. And the organizations are distributed across multiple servers, but sometimes you see these hotspots. So in order to make sure that we're able to continue providing resilient service, the service will actually move things around and move the load around so that you no longer have these hotspots. We also see a similar thing as a response to hardware failures. So for instance, if we, how many of you know Exchange? Wonderful. So if you have an Exchange DAG or an Exchange cluster and one of the servers goes down, you have to automatically reorganize in order to make sure that you don't end up having one server with all the load and causing these cascading failures. So one of the things that we did, and actually I personally was involved in that effort, we made sure that the response to a hardware failure is a redistribution of the databases in such a way that it doesn't plow over each of the servers one by one. So we made sure to structure it that way. So here's another one. Obviously, we have monitoring systems. We have systems and backup systems and actually monitors for the monitoring system to make sure the monitoring system doesn't go down. But ultimately, the best way to make sure that you don't have failures is to have a human backup and a human in loop. The one unique thing about Office 365 is that the engineers are on call. So when I was working on Exchange 2010 and Exchange Online, I was on call. I was on call a lot. I was on call from early beta on all the way through about release. And we saw those pages. We got paged for anything that the system couldn't automatically handle. At one point, I got over 20 pages in a week. At all hours of night, my wife kept asking me, are you crazy? Why are you working like this? But that was probably the best thing that we did, because not only did we make sure that we corrected the problem, but if you get woken up in the middle of the night, you're really, really, really motivated to make sure that that problem never occurs again. And I can tell you after me and my team, after we were on call with 20 pages a week, after about 3-4 months, it was down to 2 pages in a week. So it's really important to have this human in the loop and to be able to fix problems that the system doesn't know how to fix automatically. But not just that, to make sure that once you understand what the problem is, and once you're able to fix the specific problem itself, you're also able to implement automated recovery actions. And this has been done for quite a few years now. So now we really understand what the problems are that occur, and the system can automatically correct a substantial number of them. Another aspect of that same issue is inspectability and predictability. So if the system actually behaves in a predictable way, then you know that things that are anomalous, that appear out of the ordinary, can be problems that the system doesn't understand. So the system not just pages for problems that it knows exist, but it also pages for anomalous conditions. And we make sure to have the level of logging and tracing so that you're able to diagnose the problem really, really well. And this is one of the ways that we make sure that all of the outages, if any occur, they're really short. So whether it's a single server going down, which the system can automatically recover from, and an engineer goes and looks at it to make sure that it's once again restored to service, the amount of time has gone down from tens of minutes to single digits of minutes for most of these types of failures. So the system is really able to recover very, very quickly, even from problems that it doesn't understand. The other thing that we do in order to make sure that we're able to solve these problems is we have a pretty standardized hardware model. If you take some of the major low-cost airlines, you know that they deploy an entire fleet of the same kind of plane. And we do something very, very similar. We deploy all servers with a similar hardware design, which means that we have a whole bunch of backup servers that we can swap in at any point of time, and we aren't scrambling to find a backup server of that specific type. And to some extent, you can see that this is in conflict with functional redundancy. So we actually do a bit of a trade-off between the principle of complexity avoidance and functional redundancy by using the same hardware in a single data center. But we do have other hardware footprints in order to make sure that we're able to get that compromise. Another thing that we do is we test recovery across these failure domains fairly regularly in order to make sure that we don't have these types of cascading failures where one server is taking out another and another and so on. Another principle that we follow in the design of Office 365 is the principle of graceful degradation. So it sounds pretty fancy, but if you look at cars, you've got run flat tires. So if you're in Europe and driving on one of the faster highways, you're going 110 miles an hour and you have a flat. If you have flat tires, you can't continue to drive at 110 miles an hour, but you can get to 55 miles an hour and then get to a safe spot so that you can replace the tires. This is the principle that we've used. The service doesn't have an immediate outage for problems of this kind. It actually degrades gracefully so that you're still able to have service. It might be slower. It might not provide all of the services that you're used to, but certain failure modes, instead of causing an outright failure, an outright outage, would result in a reduced service. So that's more or less an outline of some of the design principles that we use in order to make sure that we're able to achieve a really, really good aggregate uptime. But what you really want to know is how the numbers translate into your organization. I mean, aggregate uptime is great, and 99.9% sounds great as well. But if it's your organization, and your organization, for whatever reason, does not have that uptime, or it's your, one of your CIOs or C-level officers that's out, you don't really care that it's a great aggregate uptime. You need to solve that problem. And we're very cognizant of the need to solve that problem, and we're very cognizant of the fact that these are separate measures. It's not, I mean, we can't tell you, hey, you know what, we have 99.9% uptime. You don't really care when your CIO is down. So the service level agreement, if you look at it, it's got a measure of uptime that is dependent on user minutes and subtracts out the downtime in terms of user minutes. The reason we came up with this formula is that it's got some nice characteristics. Longer outages, the longer the outage, the greater the impact to the percentage, which, given that you would get money back for that server, that outage, if it's sufficiently long, that's the kind of characteristic that you're looking for in terms of the uptime percentage. If it's an outage that affects a greater percentage of your users, that would also have a greater impact to the percentage, and that's also a good characteristic. So they lead, these types of impacts have greater deviations from 100%, which you want for service remedies. I mean, admittedly, service remedies that's not really what you want. You want a high level of uptime, but this gives us the incentive to make sure that we're having as high an availability as possible in terms of your own service. So one of the things that people do when they look at cloud services is they take that same measure and they apply it to the entire service. So the idea is, well, if it works for an individual customer and it works for the SLA calculation, why not take that and apply it to the entire service? The caution that I'd give to all of you when you're evaluating cloud services is that it doesn't capture the full risk picture. And some of the reasons, supposing it's downtime that that doesn't really depend on the number of users. Like, for instance, if you have a data center outage, it doesn't matter how many users you had in that data center. It could be, you know, one user or, you know, 10 million users that had their services being provided by that data center. You're still using it to adjust the number. And that data center outage itself is not dependent on the number of users that were in that data center, which means that it's not really capturing the type of problem that was had by the service. Also, if you notice, the aggregate uptime measure is heavily dependent on the definition of downtime. If you have a service where you have scheduled downtime, as opposed to, or if you have a service where you exclude downtime for a specific number of users, like 5% of users, your aggregate uptime is still very, very dependent on the downtime that you exclude from your definition of downtime. Also, if you have different cloud services that provide different functionality, it makes the uptime very hard to compare. Like, for instance, if you look at Exchange provides mail functionality and calendaring functionality, task functionality, context functionality. A lot of it gets bundled into Exchange. Supposing you had a situation where each of these services was down for 5 minutes during a month. So if you look at the uptime of Exchange, the amount of downtime that you have calculated in is 20 minutes because there's four different services. You calculate in 5 minutes per service. It's 20 minutes of downtime over the course of a month. If you separate out those services and you say you've got a mail service, you've got a calendaring service, you've got a contact service and a task service, each one has only 5 minutes of downtime, which means those separate services all have only 5 minutes of downtime, and you can actually tout higher availability numbers the less functionality you provide in each service than if you combine the services together. So this is one of those things that when you're evaluating cloud services, whether it's the ones from Microsoft or from any other provider, you want to make sure that you understand what services really go into the number so that you can have an apples-to-apples comparison of this. Also, the productivity loss due to downtime differs by service. I mean, we talked a little earlier about Outlook and how Outlook provides cache mode functionality as well as you know, offline and online functionality. To some extent, that means that if you have an outage, say of your Wi-Fi, I'm staying at the Westin, and I have to say the reliability of the Wi-Fi service is not that great. Every once in a while, it goes down. I mean, frankly, I actually had better Wi-Fi on the plane than I did in the hotel, and the fact that I have Outlook running means that I can still continue to read and respond to mail, and whenever the Wi-Fi service comes back up, I can actually connect. It sends out the mail, it downloads the changes, and I'm able to continue having a productivity experience, whereas if it was online only, some webmail client, I would not be able to have a similar kind of experience if my web access is down. I wouldn't be able to do that. So when you're evaluating the uptime numbers, you have to take some of these things into account. You have to take into account that there are these alternate paths that you can use. Even if the service is down, you can actually still continue using Outlook, or in the case of documents, you can still continue using SharePoint Workspace. And we've gone to a great deal of effort to make sure that this is the case, because we understand that you know, even if you have one of those rare downtime occurrences, your business can't stall. You need to keep providing productivity. So for a description of kind of the process of what happens when there is an outage. I'll hand it over to my colleague, Bharath.
Thanks, Kumar. So like Kumar mentioned, we do have outages once in a while, and the purpose of this section is to give you a good predictable information on what exactly happens when there is an outage, for what reasons do we have an outage, and where to look for information that we provide when there is an outage. So there are several reasons when your service can be interrupted. The first among those is very innocuous. It's a planned maintenance. It happens during maintenance windows when we expect the usage of the service to be very low. And the second kind of outage is when we make some alterations to the service. We upgrade the service, or we change some features to the service to make the service better. The third kind of outage happens when there is a service incident, and when there's a clear interruption in service due to unforeseen circumstances. And the last kind of, and this is not necessarily an outage, but you will essentially receive communications from Microsoft is when there is a lifecycle event associated with your account. Essentially when a bill is due, or when your agreement is about to expire, when your service is about to expire, or anything associated with your credit card and that sort of a thing. So these are the four categories in which Microsoft reaches out to the customer to communicate something about their service. And we use a variety of methods to get in touch with the customer. There's a direct email to the customer contact listed in the account. There is also the service health dashboard. So the service health dashboard is our primary means of communicating with the customer, but there are also other methods that we use as supplementary means of communication, such as the community forums, the Facebook page, and the Twitter account. At the end of certain kinds of outages, we do perform a post-incident review, and we send you a report on what the reason for the outage was, how long was the outage, and what we did to essentially solve that service interruption. So a lot of you will have experience essentially working in your own data centers when there is an outage and there is an escalation, there's a hot fix sent out. And engineers in Microsoft essentially work on a patch. They essentially send out the patch, and it's uploaded into your machines. That's a lot of work and a lot of stress. So imagine us doing that for hundreds and thousands of customers across thousands of servers, essentially managing that kind of an escalation for a wide variety of issues and customers. So. What used to be essentially a two-week hotfix or a patch is now compressed into a much reduced time because we have financially backed SLAs. So if our service is interrupted for a specific customer more than 0.1% of the time, which I think per month translates to about 43 minutes, we have to start paying money back.
That's actually per year, not per month.
Per year, okay. So we have to start paying money back. And if it exceeds a specific amount of time, we have to pay 50% of the money back. And if it drops below 99% or so, we have to pay all the money back. So essentially, there's a lot of incentive to fix the defect or bug as soon as possible. And people talk about economies of scale that Microsoft achieves when we operate a cloud service for many customers. There is also a factor where there is an economy of skill involved. The engineer who built the product is essentially the person who is fixing the defect. So there is a lot of experience that these engineers learn from fixing a wide variety of defects in the initial phase of deployment, and the bug rate essentially drops to a much lower level as we progress along with the service.
For those of you that are running Exchange 2010, Exchange 2010, the product benefited enormously from the fact that it was running in the service as well, because all of the experiences that I talked about, being paged 20 times, in a week and so on. All of that was on the Exchange 2010 platform that underlies Office 365. And SharePoint 2010 as well is very, very similar. So all of the experiences that we get from running the service and providing that service also translates into the server products.
Thanks. So anytime there's a service interruption, there are essentially three phases of communication. First is that we identify that an incident has happened and quickly notify that there is an incident that has happened. And then there is ongoing communication during the time that that the service is interrupted. At the end, when we restore the service, there is a post-incident wrap-up and a report that's sent out to the customer contact on the reasons for the service interruption and what we did to fix it and what we will do in the future to not let that similar sort of incident happen again. So, again, just a quick recap. There are several communication channels that we use to communicate a service interruption to the customer. The service health dashboard is the primary form of communication, but we also you can also subscribe to via RSS feed to our communication channels on service interruptions. We also send email directly to the customer. There are community forums, Twitter, and Facebook pages that essentially communicate when there is a service interruption. So the moment we identify that there is a service interruption, we essentially start assigning roles and responsibilities to different kind of people to perform a specific task. The first category would be the incident manager. The incident manager is essentially an engineer who has worked on the product. This engineer will essentially root cause the reason for the service interruption. They will essentially define the scope of the fault and will essentially also determine how long it will take to fix the fault, and they will communicate that incident to the customer. And then there's a communications manager who is also an engineer who has worked on the product, who is well aware of the product, and they constantly communicate to the customer on what's going on, how long it is going to take to fix the incident. And at the end of the service recovery, they will write up the service report and send it to the customer. Meanwhile, as all of this is going on, support is also informed of the incident. They're also given details on what the incident is. So if the customer calls up support, then they will get detailed information on the status of the service interruption. So there are a lot of signals and communication mechanisms that a customer can see to see the state or the status of their service interruption. So first that they will see is that there's a service anomaly and that a particular service interruption has happened, and they will see an icon in their service health dashboard to essentially tell them that there's something wrong with the service. And once we have confirmed that there is a service interruption that has happened, we will quickly update the icon and the status on the service health dashboard to let you know that we are working to understand the cause of failure and determine the best course of action to resolve that failure. So there will also be situations when a service interruption will result in degradation of service. So, and you will also be communicated in the service health dashboard and via other communication mechanisms that hey, there is a degradation of service, and you will sort of see reduced performances from different aspects of the Office 365 service. So once we have root caused and fixed the service, we will update the status to let you know that we are restoring the service back to normalcy and that you should expect the service to be up and running in a short time. So if there are situations when we need to do extended recovery, what we will do is we will sort of give you a basic level of functionality from the service and also will indicate to you that there is an extended period of recovery going on for you to get back your normal service. And you will be notified of that in the service health dashboard. So after the service is restored, your service health dashboard will automatically be updated to let you know that the service is now running in normal mode and it's functioning smoothly. So these are the different status messages that you will be able to see in your service health dashboard to let you know what we are doing to fix a specific service interruption. So to quickly recap, the flow of a service incident is the incident occurs, we quickly root cause to identify why this incident has occurred. Meanwhile, the service health dashboard is updated to let you know that we are investigating that incident. And then we post the incident status to the service health dashboard. And once the service is restored, the service health dashboard is updated to notify you that the service has been restored. At the end of the service, we send you a closure summary to let you know more details about that incident. So we also promise and commit to let you know about the service incident report within 5 days after the service has been restored. There is also a situation when the service is down because of planned maintenance and upgrade. There are two situations in which we introduce a downtime to the service because of planned maintenance. For the most part, the planned maintenance happens during a specific window. But there are very rare occasions in which there's a planned maintenance downtime outside of the regular maintenance windows.
Can you describe a circumstance in which that's occurred?
So essentially, when we know that, so in the past, it has occurred in situations when there has been a specific defect that has occurred involving a customer, involving one or a specific category of customers, and we anticipate that that defect could be replicated in some other set of customers. So we quickly introduce a planned downtime for customers who haven't been affected just to fix the patch and essentially make sure that the service will not be affected in those kind of circumstances for a completely different set of customers. So that's when we decide to not wait until there is a planned maintenance, but essentially accelerate that window to fix a known bug or a patch. So, sure.
So your statement there makes it sound like our mailboxes are sitting on an individual server rather than spread across a set of servers like a day. Because if I have an outage because you're doing maintenance on a set of servers, why would I as a customer see that outage? I mean, I would assume that the services would continue because
So to be clear, my understanding is there are no planned maintenance windows in Exchange Online. So this is.
If I have to patch as an administrator of the Exchange environment.
Sure.
I don't take all my DAG servers down at the same.
Right.
I don't take all my CAS servers down at the same time. So why would we be experiencing that? Because I don't provide that to my customers.
As far as Exchange is concerned, you should not see that. Your mailbox is, I believe, on 4 different servers at least, and you should not experience that for Exchange Online. Office 365 has Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, Link Online, and other services, and we're not talking specifically about Exchange Online. SharePoint Online has planned maintenance windows. And this is more applicable to SharePoint Online than it is to Exchange Online specifically.
All right.
Does that make sense?
Yep, thank you.
So in cases of planned maintenance downtimes, you will see a notification 5 business days before the planned maintenance downtime to let you know that there will be a downtime. And the service health dashboard status will be updated to say that at the time of the downtime, it will say that the downtime is in progress, and then you will also be notified once the downtime is completed. And in case we have to postpone the downtime, we'll also let you know through the service health dashboard that the planned maintenance downtime has been postponed. So, and this you will also be notified in cases where the planned maintenance window has been canceled. So that's essentially your end-to-end.
Can we go back a minute? I wanted to talk a little bit about transitions and upgrades as well. The same can be true of transitions and upgrades. So because we have online move mailbox, it's possible to do a transition and an upgrade in a completely seamless manner. But because transitions and upgrades usually have a end user impact, we want to make sure that people aren't surprised by a completely new interface, for instance. If we do a major version upgrade, you don't want your end users to, you know, go to work on Friday, see one interface, and come back on Monday and see a completely different interface. We understand that end users don't really want that. So in the case of transitions and upgrades, it's not because we wouldn't be able to do it in a seamless fashion. It's because we think that your organizations and your end users actually expect that they have a little bit of time, they have a little bit of training time, and they expect to be able to schedule those upgrades. So there's a little bit of that as well when it comes to transitions.
So I'll hand it back to Kumar to let you know how our approach.
Go ahead.
I have a quick question that's related to that.
Sure. That possibly in the future. I know there are customers that have asked for that. I don't believe it's offered today, particularly in the multi-tenant environment. As you might imagine, it's somewhat of a challenge to do that in a multi-tenant environment because there are other organizations that are being upgraded with you. But it's something that we've heard that feedback, and we are considering figuring out a way that you can do staging. So if you guys have any questions, feel free to ask. I mean, we don't need to wait till the end for questions. Please go ahead.
So our users, in this respect, basically immediate response to the issue that manifests. If we have a problem, we want to go to Office 365 primarily for email functionality initiative.
Oh, certainly. So the question was, end users expect an immediate response from support, basically, and what are we doing in order to make sure that that happens? For at least the e-plans, the enterprise plans, phone support is included, and it's 24/7 phone support. And if you call a support person, they have not just a view of the external dashboard, but they also have an internal dashboard view, and they will be able to see your specific information. So they understand what's going throughout the outage. The communication is actually not two business days. If I'm paged at two in the morning, pretty much by 2:15, the problem is either resolved or every support engineer in the organization knows what's going on. So it is an immediate response. So a question in the back.
What are your planned maintenance window timeframes? I mean, I know your main data center is in Seattle. I mean, how does that affect people in different times of when you plan? Is there a time frame like 2 to 3 a.m. Pacific time, or how do you guys handle that?
That's a good question.
So we actually customized the planned maintenance windows. For example, there was a recent one where we were introducing a planned maintenance window for Israel. And we were specifically sort of sensitive to weekend times for that specific country and early morning time. So we customize planned maintenance windows depending on the region in which the customer is located.
Also, our main data centers aren't in Seattle. We actually try and locate our data centers close to power sources. So we have a data center in Quincy, Washington. There's a few others. There's one in San Antonio. There's Dublin and so on. We actually have, I think the official number is between 10 and 100 data centers. And, you know, I know. They've disclosed some of the locations for Office 365. I believe it's most of the locations that we've already disclosed. So if you look at the web page, it tells you where the data is.
Yeah, if you visit the Trust Center, the geographic boundaries page in the Trust Center should let you know where a specific, if you're a customer located in a specific region, you will know where your data center is located.
So I saw a question over there. Yes, so we actually have at least two data centers per region. So we do have geographic redundancy, and they're sufficiently separated that it's unlikely that a natural disaster would take out more than one data center. There are some regions in which we have more than two. They are geographically redundant. So let me go ahead and present some more of the information, and I'll take more questions after that. So I want to talk a little bit about how our approach differs from our competitors. We've been in the productivity business for a very long time, and Office division produces over half of Microsoft's operating income. So it's really, really important to Microsoft as a business. And in terms of Office 365 and productivity, we're making strategic investments in making sure that we're able to provide productivity in the cloud as well as productivity on premises. And we obviously, service reliability is really important for Office 365 because that's our core business. And in order to achieve that, we actually have a software stack that helps us provide resilience. And this is something that most competitors don't really have. So it's not just to Office 365 outages. It's also to network interruptions. So how many, can I see a show of hands for how many people have better than 3.9's availability on their Wi-Fi and have an SLA around that? None. So if you actually look at the 3.9's availability, the SLA that we provide, if your Wi-Fi is down and you don't have access to the service, it doesn't matter what we provide. You actually have to use have a software stack that takes the realities of what your network is, what your end users see into account in order to make sure that they continue to be productive. And whether it's flaky Wi-Fi in a hotel or an airplane that doesn't have Wi-Fi, you want them to be able to continue being productive all the time. And when we talk about availability, we actually talk about more than just login. And it's login, it's sending and receiving email, it's sending and receiving chats. We actually understand that there's a step more that we can get to and we can measure. It's more than just login, it's actual actions that the users take. And this is what we have in our service level agreements. And of course, every user counts. So we're not having thresholding. We're not saying that a certain percentage of users have to be affected. We're not hiding our maintenance windows. I mean, we have maintenance windows for part of our stack, and that's the reality of where we're at with the engineering on those workloads. We do count every user. So if you have a one-user outage, it's counted as an outage. And we understand that there are some users that will scream loud and you really need to take care of them. And we have 24/7 support even for that one user. So if you are calling support and you're saying, my CIO's down, I need someone to look at this right now, you can do that. Also, if you look at our recovery numbers, we're really, really conservative when it comes to that. Our recovery time and recovery point objectives are probably well above what we could potentially promise. And the reason is when we test them, we want to make it as realistic as possible to not just test, but we want to simulate what would happen, and we want to promise what would happen in the stressful situation that is an outage. I mean, you've got an outage, you don't know what's going on, it's 2 a.m, you're being woken up, there's an incident manager that's saying, telling the group of engineers, you guys need to figure out what this problem is and trying to coordinate across the circumstances in which that occurs is a little different than the ones in which we test. So not only do we test on a regular basis, we make sure to have enough slack in that time for what we promise to make sure that we can deliver it. So this is really what we believe we can deliver in a real disaster. It's not wishful thinking. I mean, when we say objective, it's what we believe we can deliver in a disaster, not what we would like to deliver. Obviously, we'd like to deliver 0-0, but we're not quite there yet. So how do we make sure that it keeps getting better and better? We have executive commitment to cloud productivity services. I mean, Steve Ballmer says we're all in. We're really committed to doing that. Whenever we have service outages, I have personally seen emails from C-level people at Microsoft saying, what happened? How do we make sure this never happens again? And I'm not a manager. I'm a first line program manager. You don't normally see this level of commitment from C-level officers. And it's pretty good. When we started out delivering this service, we started out with a fairly high bar. We said we wanted to get to 99.9. We've probably delivered in the last few months, we've probably delivered 4.9s. I don't know what the official number on that. We haven't really published what the aggregate number is, but it would not surprise me at all if we were exceeding 4.9s, just given what I've seen in terms of outages. And we're committed to continuous improvements. The VP of Exchange and the one who runs Office 365 has committed to biweekly service updates. So if we see a problem, we'll make these service updates on a biweekly basis. We have feature and capability releases every 90 days. These are things that may have a minor end user impact, and things that have end user impact that are interface changes, big feature and capability releases that you would normally associate with a different server release, every 12 to 24 months. So we have a real commitment to continuously improving the service and having an availability experience that continually gets better. And you see it before the next version gets deployed. And we're not planning on stopping this. I mean, obviously, we have that level of commitment. So in summary, you can see that we engineered it for reliability and predictable service delivery. The design principles that we followed are fairly well known and understood. And we provide a great deal of information and support whenever you have service interruptions. And I hope I've provided you with a picture that lets you critically evaluate not just the numbers that we're saying, but numbers of all of the services that you're thinking about moving to the cloud. It's more than just the numbers. I want you to be empowered to ask the right questions to make sure that we're providing you with the level of service that you need. So with that, I'd like to open it up for more questions. I know there were more. Go ahead, please.
Especially with multi-tenant. So for example, the capacity installed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that that's natively baked into the product, and any time a user's doing something, you're gathering that kind of information. Is that shared?
So we don't, even in those cases, we don't gather individual user information. It's aggregated together. Do we share that aggregated information? No. The information, even the information that we gather, it's very, very restricted. My understanding is that there's probably less than 20 people in the company that have access to even the aggregated information, because we understand this is not a consumer service. Office 365 is something that we specifically designed for enterprises. It's not like it's Hotmail for enterprises. We understand that this is a business service. We want to make sure that your information stays your information, and there's no unnecessary access to any of the information that your end users generate. I mean, we're very, very cognizant and respectful of the fact that it's your information. Any other questions? Go ahead.
You mentioned that you have the data labs in multiple data centers. Which applications actually have users accessing data at multiple locations, or is it strictly like an active failover situation?
I am not really sure for all of the workloads. I'm not really sure which applications have that happen. For Exchange specifically, I can answer that question. If you look at the design of Exchange 2010.
Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Actually, if you guys could come to the mics, it might be easier so that everyone hears the questions. So the question was, we have service provided by multiple data centers. And the question was, which applications have end users accessing data from multiple data centers? So simultaneously. So the design of Exchange 2010 is that you have one active database at any given time, and there's a lot of reasons we chose that. I probably can go into more detail that you don't really want to know. But if you have that end user database situated in one data center, they're only accessing it through that data center. If it fails over, then they can access it through another data center. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of failure it is. If it's a disk failure or a server failure, they may end up in the secondary data center. But it's each end user is only accessing one data center at a given time. That said, the end users in an organization will be distributed between the data centers. So if for instance, we have one DAG stretched across San Antonio to Quincy, for instance, some of the end users in the organization will have databases in Quincy and will be accessing it through that. And some of the end users will have their databases in San Antonio and will be accessing it through the San Antonio data center. Does that answer your question? In the back over there?
Obviously, in terms of disaster recovery,
uh-huh.
I can understand you have failover from maybe one data center to another.
Yes.
So if my data was in one data center and that went down, where else is the data backed up, and how is that backed up?
So the data is actually actively replicated to multiple data centers. So the design principle that we use is that we have to hold on to at least two copies of the data at any given time. My understanding is, for the most part, those are in two different data centers. So even if there's a data center outage, your data is in the other data center. So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Great. Next one, please.
And first one is kind of a comment just on support-wise. We've had a couple of issues with delayed mail delivery. And when we called the
Right.
So just a kind of a comment to take back. The second one is similarly related, is some of the issues that we've had, we found that patching levels across the servers that we're on are not consistent, and so we're having trouble with one group of users because of the patch level versus another. And it's been very difficult to get information and schedules as far as, well, when are the group of servers that we're on all going to be patched to the same level?
That's a little surprising.
And that's what the support person said, but,
yeah,
you know,
that's very surprising, actually. So as far as the dates are concerned, I think Bharath can take that feedback and make sure that we're able to publish more information on when the patches will occur. But is this for Exchange or for SharePoint or
Exchange.
That's very surprising. That's very surprising. I'm pretty sure the way we're delivering updates to the service that the problem will be resolved soon.
And that's what
I'm actually surprised that you would have seen that in the first place, but I'd be happy to follow up with you offline. I can do that. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm just recalling about a year or so ago there was the major outage regarding DNS. I think it was related to DNS or networking equipment.
Yes. I'm very familiar with that outage.
It was a multi-hour. I don't even know if it stretched the day. I don't know. But can you take some of take that example as to maybe how the process was improved in what you covered. I don't know if it's maybe in time for user notification or improvements in that in the data area.
I'm actually not sure I can talk to the full extent of all of the ways that was that led to improvements, but I can say definitely after that we took to heart that we should be communicating better in terms of releasing information about the outage. And the process that Bharath outlined actually came after that incident.
I think at that time it was direct email communication to the customer. The service health dashboard wasn't adaptable enough to quickly show those updates, and it was essentially communicating information to support so that they can field calls when customers call them or direct email communication to customers. I think the biggest learning from that has been to update the service health dashboard because that's the first place that customers go to when there is an outage.
There were also specific improvements that were made as the result of that specific networking failure. And I'm not sure if we have a post-incident review, but I'm not sure whether a post-fix description was provided in terms of that outage. Any other questions?
Yeah. Given that we talked about the DAG functionality of Exchange 2010, do you guys have separate resiliency figures for Exchange compared to the entire Office 365? I understand the 3.9s for Office 365. It seems like it should be tremendously better for Exchange.
At this point, I don't think we have any official figures. But again, I would be very surprised if it were under 4.9s. Just given what I've seen in terms of availability. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much for your time, and I hope I've answered all your questions.